Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Mr. Duff, it is a pleasure to have you back on the show. Would you mind reintroducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Hi, Robbie. Yeah, so I'm an associate professor at the University of Chester, and I don't really consider myself an Elvis expert. I consider myself a student of the relationship between Elvis and his fans. But so as part of that, I think we're going to be talking about Colonel Parker.
Yes, we had mentioned it towards the ending of the last episode because we had talked about it on our first time. We discussed because obviously his name gets brought up when you're looking anything Google of Elvis, besides all Elvis's massive career, whether it's karate, Hollywood, you can take your pick. But Tom Parker is a name that gets mentioned a lot, and I've noticed that there's been a division between the community on how people feel about him. And I'm hoping maybe you can give me a background and maybe your perspective of his importance to Elvis's career, and if it was a help or a hurt.
Yeah, that is such a big question, isn't it? And it's one that is so prominent in the Elvis fan community and seems to be a sort of perpetual churning source of sort of concern. And I don't think it's one that's easy to answer. But I think there's a lot of things in the mix, isn't there? There's kind of Parker's mythological image. And then beyond that, there's the sort of specifics of the financial dealings, and then also questions about creativity and Elvis's creativity.
Well, how did he first become Elvis's manager? Like, when did what's Tom Parker's background? I think he's an immigrant, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so Colonel Parker was born in 1909, and at the age of, well, in his late teens, he was born in Holland. And as Andreas van Gulik, and I know I pronounced that well. He then went over to the USA, initially, I believe, to New Jersey, and spent maybe a few months or a year there, and then came back to Holland. And on that trip, apparently, he went from Boston to Liverpool, so not very far from my university. And then came back to Holland, and then went off again to America and settled there at about the age of 20 in about 1929. So really the interesting thing I think about Parker in that sense is that not only was he initially at least an illegal alien, and we kind of know that, it's a major part of the story, but also when you think about it, the first entire half of Parker's life is sort of pre-meeting Elvis. So that part of Parker's biography is still a bit kind of hazy, I think, even to the people who've looked into it a lot, like Lana Nash and others. But we know that pretty much as soon as he got into the USA, he actually served in the military for about f 4 years on and off. Initially at a place called Fort Barang sorry, Fort Shafter in Hawaii. And then a place called Fort Barrancas in Florida. And then after that, he kind of settled in Florida and in the Tampa area and was there really and pretty much until he met Elvis. So that whole kind of phase, it's fascinating because in the early part of it, we don't really know that much about the 1930s, but we know that by the end of the 1930s, Parker was organizing the marketing for Gene Austin, who by this point, Gene Austin was like a crooner and he was really big in kind of 20s and 30s kind of period. And then by the time Parker got him, he was kind of on his the down rocket of his career. And he was doing a live show called Models and Melodies, which I presume had like was like showgirls and like him singing a few songs, and this was kind of touring, and when it came round to sort of like Parker's region, he was basically helping to promote it. So he was doing that, and then also he was part of the Tampa, like a key person in the Tampa Humane Society, which was an animal sanctuary. So He actually spent a lot of the early 40s kind of looking after animals. And if you look in the local papers, there's all sorts of wonderful stories about Parker being very nice, actually, to the local animals and very avuncular and kind of, redistributing kittens that are born to local kids. Or I think this is the part of the Parker story that is fascinating in so far that, we all have this picture of Parker as being this, evil and ruthless man who ripped off Elvis Presley. And there is some truth in the ripping off part for sure. But I think when you look at that early 1940s period, the face that he presents to the world that comes through in the local newspapers there is very much, this guy's a really nice guy. He's doing things like rescuing animals that have been hit by trucks and but he was also associated with the carnival, of course. We know that from his background. And I've got a couple of interesting stories from you for that time. So in February 1943, there's a story in the local newspaper that Parker spots a dog down a drain pipe one of those big drain pipes that he has to rescue, and he doesn't know how to get down to it. So he calls one of his mates who's got dwarfism from the circus and actually kind of lowers him down to get the animal. So you've got stories like this in the paper. And then it was basically at the end of 1943 that Parker kind of quit the Humane Society. And then from then on, he was managing Eddie Arnold. And that was a sort of gradual association that built up, and it was really a rehearsal for what he did with Elvis. So for about 10 years, he's in the frame of kind of helping Arnold to tour around the kind of local area, kind of getting a break for him. And Parker really allows Arnold to hit the heights at this point and into the kind of late 50s and sorry, the late 40s and early 50s. He becomes, quite a large scale manager promoter, with a knowledge of every part of the business through working with Arnold and helping him to get the breaks.
Now, we're probably going to get to this a little bit later on, but I wanted to ask you this question now while it's fresh in my head. But do you think that the music industry turned Colonel Parker into this kind of figure that everyone kind of despises, ruining Elvis's career? Or do you think it was the mythology that people just need a person that comes out as kind of the evil figure in it? And it could be multifactorial in this, but I mean, I see evidence of where he did take money from Elvis and he did do some very manipulative manager-like things, but that's not like any other slimy kind of manager in a sense when it comes to a lot of these horror stories about musical careers. But the beginning, though, I mean, helping out at the Humane Society, I don't know about the dwarf story. That sounds like it was planted, to be 100% honest with you. I was like, I don't
Well,
know.
but that's the whole thing. There's a consistency there, isn't there? That Colonel Parker is a showman, and he's interested in kind of that kind of gathering that kind of publicity. And his role around that kind of time is to be an advance man, so that if you've got an act that's going to a new town, Colonel Parker will rock up and put up posters and other things to tell everybody about that act. And so he's sort of practiced in that marketing thing of just kind of letting everybody know. And there's a story from 1952 where Parker's in the paper because he's mass produced a load of Eddie Arnold like lace ties with Arnold's name on them. So anytime you put on a lace tie that the colonel's given you, because he gave them out to loads of people, you would see Arnold's name and it would be brand recognition. So he's kind of gloating over kind of doing that. So, I mean, I think the idea of Parker being this sort of evil, parasitic kind of character really more develops after Elvis dies. And during this period, I think people, he was sort of when he got into the spotlight alongside Elvis, which was pretty quick in terms of Elvis getting national fame, he would have been seen as sort of kind of avuncular and a bit dodgy and crafty, but not necessarily sort of extracting and evil.
When did he first meet Elvis and start to actually become his manager and get involved into crafting a career for this young stud?
Ah, so th this is a complex story, and let's see if we can dig down into it a little bit. So, okay. The reason that Eddie Arnold fired the colonel, or kind of got rid of the colonel as manager, was that the colonel had taken up with Hank Snow as an artist, and Arnold thought that he was being exclusively treated because the colonel had a 25% contract with Arnold. So when Arnold found out that the colonel had another kind of interest going, he was upset about it. So he kind of got rid of the colonel as a manager, and the colonel kind of turned around and said to him, "Well, if you're going to do that, you owe me, I think it was $50,000." So Arnold paid it off, but Arnold was still promoted by the colonel. But what the colonel then did was take the money and work with Snow to create a company for promotions. And with this promotions company, in fact, I think there were two companies, Jamboree Attractions and Hank Snow Enterprises. Then the colonel acted as a kind of regional promoter. And it was like in this era of kind of about like nine. Late 1954, early 1955, that the colonel kind of found out about Elvis, and there's still various stories about how that happened. I mean, it's clear that the colonel was familiar with the Louisiana Hayride where Elvis was performing. That was kind of regional radio, which would get Elvis a lot of his live show dates because people knew him from that. And at one point, in one of the biographies, I think it's James Dickerson's biography, he actually says that the colonel wanted to buy the hayride. So that, like, definitely the colonel knew of the hayride, and he may have found out about Elvis through there. And then there's another story that maybe the colonel's promotions man, Oscar Davis, who was I think Hank Williams' manager before Hank Williams died, and was a little bit like the colonel in terms of being a showman. Like, there's a story that he may have gone to Bob Neal, who was Elvis's second manager, because Scotty Moore initially managed Elvis, and then Bob, this local DJ called Bob Neal, did. And he may have heard Elvis's record, early records, and kind of got back to the colonel and said, "You need to check this boy out." And then,
He seems very opportunistic, doesn't he? I mean, maybe that's where later on you see him taking opportunistic choices and business decisions that weren't just more from a personal aspect of looking at Elvis's condition of his health later on that people always point at.
Certainly the colonel was highly opportunistic, but I think also anybody with any nunce in that kind of area of the business would have begun to become interested in Elvis because of the commotion he was making around his live shows around this kind of time. And I was reading in a book about the Aberbachs, who were Elvis's publisher, that they were interested in Elvis perhaps as early, if not more so, than the Colonel. So Elvis was already kind of like making a noise, if you like, in terms of this kind of marketplace, although it's very patchy. But the Colonel kind of spotted his the commotion he was creating at live shows, particularly in Texas around like very early 1955. And then basically, the colonel moved in on the deal that Elvis had with Bob Neal. So he set up a meeting with Bob Neal and Sam Phillips at Sun Records, and then he kind of moved in as Elvis's promoter and special representative. And then I believe Neal had a 1 year contract with Elvis from early 55, which kind of ran out in early 56. So basically, in that time, somewhere probably early in that time, kind of Parker sort of inserted himself as sort of special representative and kind of split things with Neil for a while. And then when Neil's contract ran out, Parker was the only person that had a kind of agreement with Elvis. But that, I mean, people have put, "Oh, they just had a gentleman's agreement with a handshake." No, they did have a contract. You can find a contract for them. But yeah, so basically, Parker moved in on Neil's kind of territory, but Neil seemed gracious about that, and also may not have had the skills to bring Elvis to a much more wider kind of national level. Parker did because of the Eddie Arnold connections, really.
Now, what did Parker feel about when Elvis went into the army? Because he's a military guy, so you would think he would be supportive of it, right? Like most military people are. But also, you're losing money, aren't you? Because he's putting his career kind of on hold a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think that Elvis going into the army was the colonel's sort of Machiavellian planning, like some people say, or the colonel invented this to kind of move Elvis's career forward and make him seem like a more like Perry Como type sort of safe family entertainer because he was in the army. What happened was that Elvis got called up, and they kind of deferred it a bit because of some of the filming he was doing and things. And the colonel kind of knew probably from his study of the industry. I mean, it wouldn't have been hard to know, for example, that previous popular musicians did all right from being in the army. It wasn't necessarily something where they would die the death because they went in the army. In fact, the army was good publicity for a lot of them. I think what happened was that when Elvis did go into the army, although the colonel would have benefited from the controversy around rock and roll being good for publicity in terms of just any news being good news, I think he would have also known that the big marketplace was in conservative entertainment for people who didn't want to be that radical. And so, you know, the sort of thing that was being done by Perry Como or Frank Sinatra or Bing Crosby or, you know, these various crooners was kind of, he would have seen that area as good for business. And Elvis going into the army was an opportunity in some ways to maneuver him towards that market.
Now, when did Elvis's career officially start getting booked places? When Tom Parker really kind of started being involved in scheduling Elvis at certain events and certain places where you start to see the beginning of Elvis Presley emerge?
Well, I mean, I think Elvis Presley began to emerge pretty much immediately that the recordings of his music got out, and he certainly in a local sense he started to be booked, and then that became like regional, and then with the Louisiana Hayride it became a bigger thing. So I think it was a gradual process of building up where the Hayride allowed Elvis to start barnstorming, what they call barnstorming, which is moving into different territories because people had heard him on the radio. So he was playing all sort of high schools and local venues and got kind of regionally big. And then, the colonel kind of took it forward.
Now, what ideas did the colonel have that really were kind of revolutionary to the way that Elvis' career kind of went? Like, was he involved in the Hollywood stuff? Was he involved in
The colonel did everything. I mean, when you think about it, the colonel got Elvis connected to the William Morris Agency. He got Elvis's RCA recording contract. He hooked Elvis up with Hal Wallace and got him into Hollywood. And then not only did he do all those things, but he kind of constantly kind of renegotiated various contracts and kind of created bidding wars so that Elvis would make the most money he could out of that process.
Okay. Now, what would you say from your perspective or your thoughts on Colonel Tom? Where does the Colonel come from? That's not real, is it?
Okay, so
is bothering me.
Well, I mean, he was in the army, but he didn't become a colonel in the army. The place where that came from was that the colonel helped a guy called, I think it was Jimmy Davis. Now, let me look in my notes for a second on this one, because I do have this information. So he was made a colonel in 1948 because the and a governor, Jimmy Davis, was having an electoral campaign, and the colonel helped with the marketing of it. And so this is a key thing, that part of the reason I think that the colonel was well connected, because he was incredibly well connected, was that he was a member of the Showman's League of America, which was a sort of organization for people connected with circuses and carnivals and things. And I think that was a kind of a network of people that's reached into politics and other places, because quite a lot of these kind of show business, sort of regional show business people would go kind of think, oh, I could go in for being governor, or I could kind of capitalize on my local publicity or popularity and kind of change my role a bit. So yeah, that's how it happened. He was an honorary colonel, but also I think in the Todd Slaughter did a book quite recently called Hero or Heel, which is about the colonel, and he said that this kind of military names like the admiral or the colonel were part of the kind of carny world, that it was kind of, you know, a sort of standard to be called things like that.
You mentioned in one of our clips, but your perspective on him said that he was kind of like a father figure to Elvis. I'm curious, what information led you to that kind of thought?
Yeah, I think we have to be a little bit careful here. I think in the mythology of the Elvis story, Parker kind of comes across a bit like a father figure, because he's a generation older and he kind of looked after Elvis's interests and kind of shepherded him through the industry. But Parker himself said, you know, I didn't think of him like a son. And I think Elvis at one point said, I think of him a bit like a father. So there's different kind of angles on this. But yeah, I mean, he definitely worked with him, supported him and helped him. And although, you know, the later deals, and we can go on to talk about how things changed, were not always in Elvis's favor, for sure. In those early years, in the 50s and early 60s, I think Parker did support and help and catapult Elvis's career to heights that were incredibly rapid, even for somebody of Elvis's talent.
Now, when it came to his financial agreements with Elvis, what was the commission? You mentioned like his earlier, I forgot, I already blanked on the name of the person that he managed before, but what was the, yes, what was the, thank you. What was the contractual agreement that he had with Elvis? Like how much was Elvis earning after every show compared to how much was Colonel Tom Parker earning?
So with Elvis, it was the same as what he'd arranged with Eddie Arnold. So it like there was an exclusivity kind of arrangement with Elvis, and Parker was to take 25% of Elvis's earnings or the monies that were accruing to Elvis, and Elvis was to get 75%. However, that percentage figure kind of altered in various ways due to the nature of the contracts and deals later on. Initially it was a 25% figure. And then I think it's about 1967 that Parker kind of begins maneuvering it in different ways. So let me see if I've got this in my notes. Yeah,
I think it was 55% he started making, compared to Elvis was starting to get like 25%.
Yeah, so in 1967, the existing contracts and renewals are on 25%, but there's 50% on new deals that are being made. So gradually Parker kind of adds to the, it kind of changes the game through the late 60s and early 70s. And I think 1967, as far as I can see from Parker's side, I would call it like the Great Reset, because he does a number of things to sort of alter Elvis's, because really when you think of Elvis in the movies, Parker is negotiating kind of better deals for him, and he's kind of doing pretty well, and he's also, you know, paid a share of the profits, and so everything's going pretty well initially. And then, you know, various things kind of strike. There's kind of compassion fatigue that Elvis has got so many films out. The Beatles come along and sort of proves that the singer-songwriter route is a good one. And so all the people that were previously writing for Elvis think, well, actually, why do I need to write for Elvis? I can, you know, market my own stuff or take it to other people or get my own publishing deals or whatever. And there's kind of diminishing returns then on the movies, and the box office kind of goes down. And so really what Parker has is almost like a strategy of failing forward, that they'd like, rather than being concerned about the artistic value of any project, what he will say is, well, listen, if you give Elvis $1 million, you've got Elvis. So this sort of strategy means that the money is used as a sort of searchlight to find projects that are sort of relevant that Elvis could do. And that process stalls when, you know, the income from the movies in terms of box office and things goes down. So eventually you get to early 1968, and Parker has to renegotiate a movie contract, and he ends up with a kind of joint movie and TV contract. And that becomes then the comeback special, and I think it's Change of Habit, like Elvis's last film. But the key thing here is, in by 1967, you know, this process is kind of on the rocket is slightly going downwards, and Elvis is starting to go a bit AWOL from the Colonel in his private life. You know, he's got this thing called the Circle G Ranch, where he's taking the Memphis Mafia out on horseback rides and things like that. And so he's plowing a lot of money into these sort of activities like that. And then he's not responding to the Colonel, and he's not responding to the studio. And so the Colonel has to get kind of come in and kind of go, well, hang on, no, you can't do this. This is not right. And so he kind of like enters Elvis's private life. And he tried before. I mean, he tried in the late 50s when Elvis was in Germany, because the Memphis Mafia were having sort of wild parties. But at this point, he gets in there and he says, you know, enough of this stuff, enough of like people like Larry Geller, enough of, you know, you being not being married to Priscilla, you know, all of this has got to change, and we've got to rearrange stuff. So basically Elvis kind of goes, oh yeah, you know, we better change things. And so lots changes from that point onwards. But yeah, in terms of the deals, where it obviously, if there's less money to be made, then even with his Machiavellian showmanship, Parker can't organize deals that are as advantageous. And you know, he was a real expert in getting stuff like side deals and consulting fees and sort of magic him up sources of income. I mean, when you think about it, this is kind of old school Carney kind of work, because like, first of all, you've got this thing of, well, you don't trust anybody. I mean, that like the Carney thing is, you know, trust people when they've earned your trust. So in that context, and especially as a promoter, Parker's going to want money up front, and preferably cash, because as we know, you know, as soon as money's not up front, people can make all sorts of excuses, or they can make all sorts of kind of accountancy claims and go, well, actually, you know, we've deducted 15% off of this for our fees here, and you've used our expenses there. And so the Colonel's like, no, you know, give us this money up front. And that wasn't unusual. Other artists did that.
We call them silver tongue devils, my friend. Silver tongue.
Yeah.
Devils.
Aretha Franklin did it. Chuck Berry did it. They all wanted money up front, I think. And then in the 60s as well, you know, there was a whole generation of managers that were probably as, if not more ruthless than Parker. I mean,
well, do you think that he was really trying to keep Elvis out of the know of what was going on with some of these things, which I believe there's probably a bit of that. But also, if we're talking about late 60s, maybe early 70s, doesn't Elvis already have Graceland? And doesn't he already have kind of his close friends and set up? I mean, that's what he wanted all along, was having his family and his friends all surrounded around him and being able to live with them on a property and be able to just be free in a sense. So there's not a lack of wanting to know what all the money and being so obsessed with it at that point. I mean, you want to be with your family and friends.
Yeah, I think so. And in a sense, the movie life did afford some of that lifestyle for Elvis for sure. And he did get that, but at the same time, you know, that couldn't last forever. And also a lot of people have given evidence to suggest that, and from Elvis himself, that he was unsatisfied in creative terms with kind of doing the same movie over and over again. So the Blue Hawaii template, if you like, was wearing thin on Elvis himself.
I think he didn't. I mean, what are your thoughts on him as an actor in all of his movies? Because he's actually really good. Like, I was surprisingly shocked, I would say, when he mentioned that he didn't like doing those movies and he regretted some of his movies, the Hollywood career. And I was like, that sucks, because I actually enjoyed watching him in some of those older ones when he's at like a bar. You know, like that's that to me, that was interesting. He was a really good actor. That's not easy stuff to do, but he played the part.
I personally love loads of different Elvis films, and I think that a lot of them are interesting for different reasons. And there's a famous quote from Elvis, which is said, the only worse thing than watching a bad movie is starring in it. But like, actually, the films of the 50s are very dynamic. Some of the films of the early 60s and even sort of odd ones in the late 60s are interesting. And I think the thing is, part of me thinks, well, look, everybody knew this was Elvis when they saw him on screen. He was an icon. He was a famous singer. And so he could never disappear into a role, a bit like some of the method actors could, just because of our knowledge as an audience of that. However, I think Cher got an Oscar for her acting, and everybody knows Cher when they see Cher. So in that sense, Elvis could certainly act, yeah. So I mean, definitely when you look at those films like King Creole or Jailhouse Rock, you know, he's got a certain on-screen charisma and presence and emotionality, and he can kind of pull off that end of things. But yeah, in the end he didn't feel that he was kind of getting his due or getting roles that would allow him to do that. And of course, the last time that was knocked on the head was the offer to appear in A Star Is Born in the mid-70s, by which point really he probably wouldn't have, he would have fitted that role in terms of his actual biography and life, but it would have been so close to home that could have been a bit painful for him.
Why do you think he regretted the whole Blue Hawaii family vibe that he was starting to portray in movies?
I don't think he regretted it. In the sense of, in a lot of ways, it was good for his career, even when he went back into live music, to have that as part of his reputation. But I think that what he regretted was getting kind of sort of stuck in that template and things not very moving very far from it for his later films. So I don't think he necessarily saw it as a terrible thing to do, but it was the constant sort of reworking of it or the entrapment in it that he didn't like, because he didn't really have any control over the scripts and the placement of the songs and things like that. He had a certain limited capacity to kind of change the creative world. And of course, when you look at what he did in the studio, that kind of creativity was very much his domain.
Now, how much did Tom Parker play when it came to the drug habit of Elvis? I read a little excerpt from, I don't remember what book it was, but there was an excerpt that was on an article or a website or something. But they had mentioned in a brief little paragraph about that Tom Parker, I want to make sure I remember this correctly, but Tom Parker wanted to get Elvis some help with some of his prescription drug use, but didn't want to do it in a place that would make the information public and didn't know of a discreet place to take him. Whether it was also with fear of if that information got out, would Elvis lose gigs or something of that sort, which again, that's a very crappy manager thing to do when you look at the overall health of a person. But also he had that image in mind. Now, whether it was for money or whether it was for Elvis's own good, you know, that has to be weighed as factors. But I think that's something really important a lot of people don't really consider. They kind of just think that he just pumped him with drugs and pushed him on stage. And it was like, look, it could be multifactorial there.
And I think it was multifactorial, because I think Parker knew in the later years that Elvis's drug habit was no good for either of them, and it would be great if things could change, but I don't know if he knew how to do it. And I think that you're right insofar that sometimes Parker was in damage limitation mode. And there's a good example of that when a member of the Memphis Mafia accidentally had a bad car accident. I think they killed somebody, or there was a sort of significant car accident. And Parker told Elvis to get out of town and to not have anything to do with this situation. So there was definitely, Parker was adept at sort of damage limitation and covering things up for the sake of publicity. But I don't know, because I think by the end, things got pretty bad in all different ways from what I can understand. And, you know, you've got things like the book Elvis, What Happened, coming out in the tabloid press. You've got Elvis's health significantly declining, and, like, you know, Elvis not being able to be roused for some meetings with the colonel. So the colonel kind of is clear at that point that he's lost Elvis. And so you've got a sort of down spiral where it, like, whatever Parker could do was limited, really, in that environment. And Todd Slaughter in his book talks about the colonel trying to get Elvis over to Europe to do a show, to give him something to kind of look forward to and to kind of get him back on track. And so there is this sort of theory that, you know, maybe one way you could save Elvis was by giving him kind of a big creative challenge to pull off. But, you know, clearly that didn't fully work or materialize towards the end.
Why did the colonel limit Elvis's touring outside of the United States? He didn't want him traveling overseas.
Well, this is a classic question, isn't it? And I don't think that we fully know the answer to it. So there's multiple levels of this. So the colonel had gone abroad in the early years because he went to Canada when Elvis was playing there in the 50s. So we knew that the colonel could travel. And also, so I think the first one to get out of the way is this question of Parker being an illegal alien, right? Because, you know, he came from Holland, he didn't get his papers sorted out. So therefore, was he an illegal alien all the time? And would that prevented him getting a passport and traveling? And as far as I understand it on that, I think it was the end of the 1930s, there was a sort of amnesty on illegal aliens, which said, if you served in the military, you can become an American citizen. And Parker didn't take it up when he could have done. And part of the reason for that, I'm guessing, was that he had that thing of playing all sides of the equation, you know, that, like, that whole thing with the I hate Elvis badge and the I love Elvis badge, and Parker kind of making money off both. Well, if you're not an American citizen and not a Dutch citizen, then you can actually be kind of immune from prosecution. And of course, he played that card later on in the 80s when he was accused of kind of overreaching and fraudulent activity and mismanaging Elvis. So I think with his connections, he knew a lot of high up people, he knew American presidents and all sorts of people. He could easily have got a passport or got them to turn a blind eye and traveled. So I don't think it's because Parker wanted to stay at home and he was an illegal alien. In fact, if anything, I think he would have been quite happy with other people going with Elvis and making sure it was all right from a distance, which is what the army, you know, was a practice for. I've read some people saying, you know, well, you know, he didn't go to Germany because the Nazis during the Second World War kind of, you know,
were a bit of a stretch.
Terrible to his family.
Bit of a stretch.
Yeah, that one's a stretch, because Parker was estranged from his family until the early 1960s, and so he probably wouldn't have known. And so he might have been annoyed with the Germans in like getting into Holland or whatever, but it was not his own family, I don't think. So I don't think it's because the colonel didn't have a passport. I think they wanted to go over, and they were continually promising, and I think they would have done it when the time was right, but maybe the time was never right. You know, it was sort of but it was sort of a plan C on the list that never needed to materialize, I think. Although some people have said, well, you know, later on, could have been because Elvis carried firearm and, you know, that would have been an issue, or it could have been because Elvis had that thing with prescription medication and that would have been an issue. Maybe, but it's a moot point if it never fully happened.
I was trying to look up the name of it, but is it RCA or RVA? That was the
RCA, the record company. Yeah.
Yeah. The record company RCA. I mean, how much impact did that have on Elvis's career? I think they owned most of his rights to his music, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. So there was, Elvis was an RCA artist from 1956 onwards, and there were all sorts of ways he benefited from that, even down to things like, you know, the Colonel getting them to release stuff on 8-track, or the Colonel getting them to release Having Fun on with Elvis on Stage, another, like, which is a spoken word album of like bits from Elvis's performances. And which, you know, we look back on and think, oh my goodness, that's a terrible idea for an album. Yeah, probably so. But what it did at the time was get out some more money in for Elvis. So I think, like, in a lot of ways, Parker could use RCA to kind of get, like, as a cash cow to bring in more money. But then at the same time, and also Parker actually arranged with RCA to get into touring and to sort of manage and sponsor Elvis's touring for a while, to create a bit more competition or kind of a bit more support, perhaps. But I think, you know, in the later deals, the one you're talking about is 1973, which is sort of, I say, like the Parker Great Reset number two, probably. And in that one, Elvis was selling his back catalogue, and they got a deal where Parker was brought in on it. Elvis wanted to sell it because Elvis's finances were in a little bit of a mess in around that kind of time, even to the point where he did briefly borrow some money from the bank. I think about $300,000. So given that, when you think of it, it's incredible that Elvis would have made tens of millions of dollars in his lifetime, perhaps hundreds of millions. And yet, you know, he was in this state of borrowing money because of the way that he'd spent it, and, you know, airplanes and giving away cars and all these different things. So because he was needing the money, he wanted to sell his back catalogue, and then Parker was kind of roped in to try and get a good deal, and Parker did get a good deal, and apparently he bargained RCA up about 75% on what they were going to give. But so the net of the deal, I think, was something like $10.5 million, but then out of that, I think the Colonel got $6 million and Elvis got $4.5 million. So it was like, you know, the Colonel was doing things for himself at this point. Some of that doing things for himself was coming because he was cutting in on the chain. So if there was a kind of deal going on, there were possibly multiple entities on the chain of the deal. So, I mean, merchandise is a classic example of this. You know, Parker would license Elvis's likeness and image out to a company that would kind of create merchandise, and of course Elvis got a fee for that, and then the fee would be split between Elvis and Parker. So later on, Parker would go, okay, you know, I'm going to do the merchandising myself, so I'm going to create a business that does it. So then a whole bigger chunk of that money then goes to me. So some of it was like this kind of thing of cutting other entities out of the deal, but then some of it later on particularly was just, no, this was Parker getting a bigger percentage for himself and getting Elvis to agree on that before he did it.
Do you believe that Parker made agreements with casinos because of his gambling debts to have Elvis play there?
Well, that's a controversial one, isn't it? I was reading recently, I think it was in Adam Victor's book, the Elvis Encyclopedia, that he said that something like Alana Nash thought, and as though, you know, it's sort of friend of a friend of a friend thinks. Put it like this, it is possible, isn't it, that the Colonel's gam. I think it's I think it's actually likely that the colonel's gambling debts necessitated some kind of money-making operation that would keep them afloat. Yeah. So, and the Las Vegas did provide that. It provided that stable source of income. But how far you go beyond that into questions about, you know, was that gambling addiction a way to kind of create a kind of basically to create some kind of servitude or like keep him there as the key draw? I don't know. And I don't, you know, I think it's a dangerous territory to get into. I don't know. I don't actually know. But I have seen it before where other managers have got gambling addictions. And you do wonder about it, don't you? You wonder, like, is this
Bruno
a way
Mars
for...
owes $500 million to the MGM Grand.
Yeah, yeah. You wonder whether this is not just about somebody having a gambling addiction, but about them having a relationship with the casino for financial purposes.
Well, most music producers are people that are booking managers, try and create relationships with certain places so they can keep booking and have a reasonable schedule with certain. I mean, that's how you do business. It's like being a DJ. You want to be friendly with the guy who owns the bar so you can keep coming back to DJ at the bar. So that would make sense if Colonel Parker would have all these agreements or maybe ideas of places that he wanted to make sure he got it in with, whether it was an auditorium or stadium or something like that, that would get the most money from a venue. You have good clientele when you come to town. I mean, the thing about Parker is,
I think that's a crucial thing to say, isn't it? That this is about creating mutually beneficial relationships, and that's clear, yeah.
I think a lot of people want to look at Parker through the eyes of a good, close manager friend. And I don't think necessarily that's how the relationship worked. I think there was beneficial moments when it came to Elvis in certain scenarios with Parker. But I think if you really examine it from at least what I could tell, it just seems more of like Parker was like, this is business. I'm going to make as much money as possible. And without, like, not saying he's pushing Elvis down at all, but being friendly in a sense, but in the sense caring more about the money than necessarily where a person who might be a close friend who's a manager might go the extra step to be like, hey, we don't need to do this because you might need to take a break.
I think for Parker it was business, but I also think that he did care about Elvis's welfare within that arrangement. So maybe it's not just simply, oh.
The true answer to the question is, was he allowed at Graceland?
Was he allowed in Graceland?
Yeah. Did he ever visit?
Well, he certainly visited on occasion, so I think so.
Allowed inside, that's how you know Elvis didn't like him.
Yeah, that's a good question. And we'd have to double check on that. I mean, how many pictures do we see of him in Graceland? I mean, there's certainly... I think at the end of the day, it was a business relationship and it was a positive business relationship. But if you've got a business client, you're going to want to make sure that, you know, they're doing all right. I mean, there's a famous thing where Parker had a friend who helped him out, who had a printing business in his early days and I think gave him a line of credit or something like that. And then for years and years and years later, even decades later, Parker helped his friend who had a printing business, and he printed a lot of Elvis's stuff. So I think when the colonel felt you'd done him a favour, he was loyal to you. And I think that is a key thing, because in a sense, you know, he evidently had skills. He could have moved on beyond Eddie Arnold and beyond Elvis to pick up another artist and do pretty well with them, but he didn't. He stayed with Elvis despite all of that trouble that Elvis himself was creating as an artist. So yeah, Parker was clearly exploitative, particularly in the later years, but also he was loyal.
Do you think the recent Elvis movie gave a good depiction of Tom Parker?
Well, it reminds me of
I keep going back and forth on calling him Colonel to Tom Parker. I just don't like the Colonel name that much. Unless he's making chicken, I ain't calling him Colonel.
I remember Jack, when the Colonel died, Jackson Brown wrote some interesting stuff, and he said, you know, to call Parker a con man is merely to give him his due. And I think that's the key thing with the Colonel, like his whole image. I mean, that's something we haven't really talked about, but the Colonel's kind of uncanny image as a sort of showman and kind of rip-off merchant. Yeah, that, I mean, in the Elvis film did depict that. Well, I don't think it was really accurate. It wasn't, I mean, and that was signified, wasn't it, straight from the start of the movie. The idea that Parker was walking around the casinos with a drip on, you know, is kind of a slightly absurd. So, you know, it wasn't, it was like Baz Luhrmann clearly said, you know, this is in the territory of myth. It's not supposed to be taken as fact. But the mythosphere of Parker's kind of celebrity image is quite interesting. And I think when we think about rock and roll, you know, there's quite often this conception of low culture, which kind of comes out of this idea of mass culture, which is, you know, the idea that everybody's being conned by commerce. And so the audience isn't really getting what it thinks it's going to get. It's just being ripped off. It's just, they're gullible people. They're going to be conned by some kind of hype. And the Colonel's image completely fits that, doesn't it? There's all that, all those stories about him being a carny and doing this stuff like the painting of the sparrows yellow to pretend they're canaries, or getting chickens to dance on a hot plate, or you know, probably which hardly any of them would be true, I would doubt. I mean, given his work in the Humane Society, I think he loved animals and generally did nice things with them. We have this image of, or the, like the Colonel hot dog stories, like the Colonel sells hot dogs and he puts one sausage down in the dirt, and so he just sells somebody a bun when he gives them the hot dog, and they say, where's my hot dog, and he just points in the dirt to say, you dropped it. You know, this is sort of Colonel mythology. I don't think really that he did all that stuff, but he certainly was a practical joker. And he liked to kind of manipulate people and kind of pull stunts and things. So he kind of knew that image. And there's that famous moment, isn't there, in I think it's 1972 at the Madison Square Garden event, where the Colonel basically says, okay, I'd like to live up to my reputation of being a nice guy. That's it, folks. And closes the press conference. So he knew that his reputation was as this sort of fearsome character, but that's the role of a manager. They've got to keep people away. And there's all these stories about, you know, people would phone up for Elvis and the Colonel would go, oh, he's just gone. And then he, you know, he'd go off and sort of run down the corridor a bit and come back and go, I know, I couldn't catch him. He's just gone. Sorry about that. And of course, you know, it's all bunk, but this is sort of how the Colonel operates. It's sort of in the bunk world.
How much of the myth of Tom Parker was created by authors and just people kind of inserting their various stories and this legend kind of spreading out there based on what you've seen as reality?
Well, I mean, I'm not in a place to judge reality because I never met the Colonel, but I've read about him for a few years and kind of, you know, met people that have met him and other things like that. And the impression I get is that, in part, it's a co-creation, insofar that I think the Colonel reveled in his public image as a showman. He reveled in his public image as kind of slightly kind of cold or kind of untrusting and kind of manipulative. But at the same time, I think the idea that the Colonel was thoroughly parasitic wouldn't have necessarily been something that he would have wanted to have put forward. So I think that side of it maybe does come more from the authors and things.
Do you know much about the relationship between him and Elvis's family?
Yeah, I know a few things. I mean, I think when Elvis died, apparently it was on the day of the funeral that Parker kind of popped up with a new contract for Vernon to sign, which suggests a kind of lack of respect.
Was it about the estate?
Yeah. So Parker wanted to continue running everything as he had before, basically. But of course, with Elvis dead, he didn't have a kind of signature to do it. And so Elvis's father being the next of kin would have been that kind of signature.
He died a few years later, didn't he?
Elvis's father died a couple of years after Elvis, so he was still around once Elvis died. Yeah, and you can see him on the end of the CBS special, kind of regretfully talking to fans and kind of closing it up. But yeah, so I think there was some kind of contact there. I mean, I don't know. I read that Parker may have paid for Gladys's funeral, or kind of, he's certainly done things like put flowers on the grave and send pictures to Elvis, things like that. But again, I mean, equally with Elvis, I wouldn't say that the relationship is necessarily a close one.
Who
It's
wasn't,
a
oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, who was in charge of the comeback special? One of those peak moments in Elvis's career that kind of put him back on the right track.
Well, Elvis was in charge of the comeback special along with Steve Binder, but I mean the Colonel did have a stipulation that he wanted it to be a Christmas show, right? And so that was part of the sort of tail end of like the Colonel reset, was kind of like forging this comeback special, and then getting Elvis into Las Vegas. And in the comeback special, the Colonel, there was he'd done things like kind of radio special with Elvis in previous recent years that kind of showcased him beyond the movies. So we thought, okay, let's do some TV, but how are we going to do it? And the Colonel's idea supposedly was that it was going to be like a kind of Perry Como, kind of Andy Williams type thing, where it was going to be sweaters by the fire or whatever, and a Christmas special, with kind of carol singing or that kind of thing. But in the end, the network got Steve Binder, who kind of worked with Steve Allen, and he'd worked on the TAMI show, and he'd worked on a special called Petula with Petula Clark, that and all of these were kind of seen as a bit more edgy or radical programming in terms of race and things. Elvis was working with younger people, that they wanted to showcase him in a different and more dynamic way, and kind of sum up his career to date. And he was given kind of more or less carte blanche to do that. And then when the Colonel saw the final result, the Colonel was like, "Well, where's the Christmas stuff?" And they were like, "Well, yeah, we've got Blue Christmas. Let's put that in. We can include that." And so the comeback special is sort of seen as symbolically like the moment where Elvis kind of resisted the Colonel and kind of became his own creature. But of course, Steve Binder was no longer part of Elvis's life after the special. And Binder's not the only creative who was kind of cut out of Elvis's world. We know Jerry Lieber, from Lieber and Stoller, was kind of cut out. We know Larry Geller was kind of marginalized, shall we say. And I think this is one of the things that Parker did when he perceived there was kind of competition for Elvis's attention and creative direction. He would maybe sometimes get in there and kind of marginalize them in different ways.
When it comes to examining a figure like Tom Parker, especially when you're looking at Elvis fandom, how important do you think he is to the overall story of Elvis? And then also, how would you recommend, from at least a proper examination? Clearly, people are going to have feelings walking into looking at Tom Parker a certain way, just because I think a lot of people want to. I mean, even for me, there's a lot of things. It wasn't until Sally Hodell's book, and talking to her about his chronic health issue, that I kind of started going, yeah, that explains a lot of the rapid weight gain, a lot of bloating that started happening. It's not that he was just shoving hot dogs down his face. I don't believe that. But it gave an explanation of someone that was obviously dealing with something that is kind of psychologically hurting and then also physically hurting as well too. I have a digestive disorder like that, so I know what that's like when she started explaining it, and it's not fun stuff to go through. So seeing his rapid weight gain, and then obviously people are going to be writing articles about you and tabloids, and you're going to hear all these stories like the banana peanut butter sandwich and all this. That, I mean, whether he was alive to hear some of those stories or reading the articles when it was happening, it's not something easily taking a toll on your mind. And I think when you really examine a reason of why Elvis got into this scenario, you want someone to blame. And I think if you look at Tom Parker a little bit, he's a very controversial figure, but I think he's overall important. Whatever you decide of what he is, you need to kind of look into him.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, as we're offering our opinions on this, going back, we'll deal with your mega question a bit at a time. Going back to that sort of fact, because you mentioned fans in the first place, I think Parker was always kind to fans, actually. And he did things like he wouldn't charge the fan clubs for photographs, the use of photographs. He would generally try and put fans in the front row at events, and kind of keep good liaison going with the various fan clubs and things. That maybe the one exception to that, which is interesting, is the comeback special, because apparently Parker was due to kind of organise the audience for that and then kind of fluffed it up in some way, perhaps deliberately. But in terms of sort of Elvis's weight gain and blame and questions like that. Okay, so I think probably what could have been more significant to Elvis's life was the loss of his mother and his relationships with women. And if you think about it, Elvis was never fully faithful, as we know. And in a sense, after his mother died, there's a sort of 20-year experiment, really, in existentially almost, in whether life, should go on for Elvis. And ironically, his career goes on in different ways. But I think there's a psychological theory called enmeshment. And then the idea of enmeshment is that sometimes people get too close to one of their parents, right? And Elvis is well known for this, right? He's sort of had a close relationship with his mother. And people who are enmeshed, psychologists say, have a tendency towards addiction. And, that doesn't have to be, hardcore drugs. It could be work, it could be sex, it could be food, could be, prescription drugs. And when you kind of look at what Elvis was about, a lot of those you kind of go, well, yes, there was a certain element of that. So I think perhaps that's a way to answer it, that when you look at when he had that weight gain, it was around the time of the divorce, wasn't it? And after the divorce, I think it'd be interesting to do some kind of correlative study to if we got any data on exactly what Elvis's weight was at any particular point. But yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on the health matters, but
It's the certain areas for me where he gained weight looked like it was bloating, like it was water weight. Mostly because he kind of still kept like a relatively thin body. Like it wasn't like he was like pouring out of the sides and needed like five seats to travel or anything. It's just a lot of it was in his face. And there's some around the lower part of his belly. But like his arms, usually you gain it everywhere. You gain it in your arms, you gain it in your chest, you gain all that. He would just kind of had it hanging in certain pocketed areas, which was, if it's in your stomach specifically, that's alcohol. You can get that pretty quickly from just having a large
yeah,
consumption of
right, your beer
alcohol.
belly, yeah.
But if it's in the mouth, a lot of the time, it's usually when it's face weight gain. It's if it's not happening over your body, it's a dental issue. Whether it's abscess or it's something that's going on with his hygiene that's not properly being taken care of. But he was gaining it in his face, which makes me know that that's a chronic health issue, whether he's got a thyroid problem. So there's a lot of things like this. Yeah.
Yeah, there are certainly, I mean, it's perfectly possible to have your face swell due to immune responses. But that's usually, I'm guessing, temporary, because I get a little bit of that actually sometimes.
Unless it's a chronic health issue, then it can happen permanently.
Well, yeah, I mean, thyroid can do all sorts of things. I mean, one of the things that's interesting, isn't it, that on the night that Elvis died, he was playing racquetball. And if you're significantly overweight, I would assume it's pretty tough to play racquetball very easily if you're really out of shape. So, yeah, I'm not really a medical expert to sort of say in any direction what happened there. And I know Sally's done a lot more research on that than I have.
It was just an interesting take. I'm not saying it's 100% like that's what it is, but it just would sum up some things about, obviously, there's a lot about Elvis that gets kind of clouded and it gets hard to kind of decipher who he was or what he did, because you have this version of him, you know, riding a tractor at Graceland, and then you have this version of him on stage towards the end where he's, you know, sweating and he looks like he's really going through something. And then it's over with. And then you hear like he died on the toilet. And it's like, that's not what he is, though. He's so much more. You got to condense him down. I don't like watching his karate videos as much as some people might like it. To me, it's just sad to watch it. Because in a lot of those, he just looks like he's cutting something, whether it's something he's cutting out of his life, addiction wise, or something like that. But he just doesn't look good to me. You know, he looks fresh on stage. He looks like a different person than when I see him in either in a movie or see him in his any other activities he was involved in. It actually looked like what he looks like when he's at Graceland. Happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's those last sort of on and off in those last sort of maybe 5 or 6 years that things kind of deteriorate, isn't it? Because, you know, he was able to sort of look amazingly dynamic in That's the Way It Is, which was right at the start of the 70s. And apparently the Colonel wanted to edit that quite a bit. So there's the sort of gives a lie to the idea that the Colonel had no role in the creative process. Occasionally he did. Want to do things, but yeah, I suppose the question is how much is the Colonel to blame for that changing Elvis, given that the Colonel was arranging Elvis's work life to some degree? And I don't know, because there's contradictory sort of messages there. One would be no, that you know the Colonel is actually giving something Elvis to live for. And Elvis likes to be in front of an audience, and so the Colonel's trying to provide that. And the opposite message is, well, the Colonel's worked Elvis to death. And this is, you know, Elvis just doesn't have anything other than in his life than work. And no, I think Elvis's psychology is down to Elvis, and he had the responsibility to sort it out, and he never fully did. I mean, in a way, despite being an incredibly amazing singer, he was an indulged person, wasn't he, to a large degree, and he never fully got a handle on his own issues, I don't think.
Do you think that the Colonel overall, would Elvis's career have been beneficial or negative without him?
I think that Elvis had a much more stellar career than he would have had much more quickly with the Colonel, and that benefited him in a lot of ways. But ultimately, perhaps, you know, if you get to that level of show business, we've seen quite a few people implode. It's not just Elvis, you know, Amy Winehouse or whoever, you know.
Robert Palmer.
Yeah, I mean a lot of people have health problems and issues and things,
To be fair, that guy smoked like 60 what cigarettes a day or something like that. That dude, I don't even know how he could sing like that.
that can't do you too good, can it? Yeah. So yeah, it kind of is what it is, isn't it? I mean, and I don't think that it would be nice to sort of institute a law that says, you know, however privileged the person is as a celebrity, there comes a point where we just need to section them and then sort them out. And that, you know, if they're going down the wrong road, but maybe that's draconian, but it might have saved Elvis. Who knows? I mean, he didn't. I suppose that what a lot of people would say was that, no, at that point in time, there were none of the facilities and none of the mental health kind of, you know, structures that would have really and attitudes that would have supported the change to be made, you know, because you need to check yourself into places, you need the right kind of counselling and support and all of these other things. And that just wasn't what people did in the South in the 50s and 60s or whatever, and just didn't happen.
Well, Mark, I appreciate the time you gave me to talk about this on my show. And I appreciate sharing your information with me as well, too. Is there a place where people can find any of your links?
Yeah, I still haven't got my website going. I used to have it going, and then I got busy with a lot of other things. But you can link some of my Amazon books, and yeah, people can contact me at the University of Chester if they want to or whatever, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, and thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blanket. Stay tuned for our next episode.